Please be seated. Good afternoon. We hear our third case for today, 09-AP-639, Tracy J. McGreath versus Timothy J. McGreath. Arguing on behalf of Mr. McGreath is Attorney Andrew W. Erlandson. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. May it please the Court, my name is Andrew Erlandson, representing the respondent, appellant, and petitioner, Timothy McGreath. Your Honors, this case presents the Court with a genuine opportunity to enhance the justice system's ability to effectively serve its essential purpose, which is to deliver fair and just results to parties who bring their disputes before the courts of the state. Petitioner Tim McGreath respectfully requests that this Court create a clear framework to assist trial courts in evaluating property division and spousal maintenance issues in cases involving divorcing professionals, to ensure that the value attributable to the practicing professional's personal goodwill does not get what's known as double counted. Now, this case, as the justices are no doubt aware, centers on the concept of goodwill. Now, goodwill is generally defined as the value of a business over and above the value of the business's fixed and tangible assets. In the case of a professional practice, courts around the country and commentators recognize that there are essentially two components of goodwill associated with a professional practice. There is the enterprise goodwill associated with that practice, which is attributable directly to the business itself, and which would continue to exist independent of any association with an individual professional's continued presence at the practice. There is, in addition, personal goodwill. The personal goodwill of a professional practitioner inheres in the individual. It is attributable to that professional's personal skill, personality, experience, and reputation. Personal goodwill, more accurately, reflects the professional's earning capacity, and therefore, we respectfully submit that absent unusual circumstances, the value of that professional's earning capacity is best considered in awarding spousal maintenance and other family support.
Counsel?
Yes.
When I tried these cases at the trial court level, I cannot remember a time when a business, large or small, was valued and the value of the goodwill was then split out into personal goodwill and enterprise goodwill. Are you asking for wholesale change in how family court cases are decided from this point forward? I mean, typically you'd get a goodwill figure, but not then, oh, personal goodwill, enterprise goodwill.
Respectively, Justice Ziegler, I don't believe we're blazing any new trails. In Holbrook versus Holbrook, the Court of Appeals, in the context of a professional practitioner's business practice, stated that when you attempt to distinguish professional goodwill from the practicing professional's earning capacity, the concept of goodwill evanesces. And so in cases particularly involving solo practices, the professional's personal goodwill, which is that goodwill which he or she would take away from the practice in the event that the practice was sold, is in fact that professional's earning capacity. There are courts around the country that have embraced the distinction in the case of professional practices, particularly solo practices like Dr. McCreath, that recognize this distinction.
Those are largely non-community property states.
Well, I believe that there are many states which are community property states which recognize
maybe
that
10.
Distinction.
Maybe 10, and about 6 of those don't do it the way you're suggesting.
There are states like California which adopt a view that everything is divisible. And the rule that Dr. McCreath is advocating and proposing here is to create a presumption that professional goodwill and earning capacity of the divorcing professional be considered when establishing a maintenance support award to the non-professional spouse. But it is to serve the overarching goal to avoid the possibility or likelihood that in a case where maintenance is awarded and all goodwill associated with a professional practice is treated as a divisible asset, there is impermissible double counting, which this Court flagged as a red flag and an impermissible result nearly 50 years ago in Cronforst.
So like someone who owns business, that would be, it doesn't have to be a profession like an orthodontist or a doctor. It could be someone who owns a business because the business would have computers and this and that, and they would have certain assets that would be divided. But because that person has particular charisma or clients or whatever, they could close up that business, start a new one, and it's their personal goodwill that would hold it. So really, you're asking for a rule across the board, not just for this situation of a professional, but any time somebody has personal goodwill, that be something that's considered as part of maybe the maintenance equation, but not property division, right?
Yes, and to follow up on that question, Justice Ziegler, in such a case, not a professional practice, if indeed a business that is the subject of property division is uniquely dependent upon the qualities of an individual, which would leave from the business in the event that the business was sold, it really becomes a valuation question, where in assessing what an arm's-length buyer willing to buy but not compelled to buy and an arm's-length seller willing to sell but not compelled to sell would arrive at as a fair value. And to the extent that that individual continued to possess some unique charisma or economic acumen, it would be properly considered not in the value of the business and not as a marital asset, but rather in assessing the earning capacity of that divorcing spouse in establishing a maintenance award.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Rogensack, did you have a question?
Yes, I was going to ask you, didn't Mrs. McGreeth participate in the development of his personal goodwill by providing services to his dental practice and services at home to raise the children?
Certainly.
Then why is it that you think she shouldn't have any part as a property division in this personal goodwill?
Because, Justice Rogensack, that value is more readily determinable, more efficiently determinable, and more fairly determinable as a component of a maintenance award, which is effectively an annuitized return on all of those contributions and investments.
Well, it might be more effectively determined as a Chapter 51 payment if it couldn't be changed. But as we all know, maintenance is subject to change, and incomes, particularly of professionals, Dennis is a good example, are quite flexible in regard to whether the dentist wants to work many hours a week, which I understand Mr. McGreeth did, or whether he'd like to work 3 days a week, which many orthodontists do.
Well, I think, Justice Rogensack, the maintenance calculus is multi-pronged and flexible enough to account for those variables. In addition, the maintenance awards under the framework that Dr. McGreeth advocates include a flexibility where there is a presumption that personal goodwill, which is a reflection of the professional's earning capacity, is most accurately a component of maintenance in terms of delivering a fair result. However, there are other cases, myriad cases, with different facts which might compel a trial court to invoke the flexibility in the framework Dr. McGreeth proposes to say that, well, no, we're going to take a look at this snapshot in time, and we are going to assign a net present value to the value of this business, including all of its goodwill. But then the fact that the non-professional spouse has been compensated for that net present value needs to be taken into consideration when maintenance is awarded to avoid the double counting problem, which the Court of Appeals described as being essentially ignored here.
I guess what I was focusing more on is the lack of any counting for the wife's contribution to the development of personal goodwill. I understand your argument about the double counting and how you think Cronforst applies, and that was well developed in your submissions to us. It seems to me that what you'd like to label personal goodwill is something that took the efforts of more than one person to create.
And if he were to stop practice, he would attempt to sell that by virtue of a non-compete agreement, which is not applicable here because he's going to continue to work. And he would be compensated for that at that time. So I'm not so concerned about double counting as I am concerned about her getting absolutely no benefit from the fact that she helped develop what you are now characterizing as personal goodwill.
Justice Rogensack, clearly, the contributions of the non-practicing spouse should be considered by any trial court in attempting to fashion what is a fair property division and a fair maintenance award. In the event that circumstances changed following divorce, let's say Dr. McCreath were to sell the practice, which was not contemplated at the time of the trial court proceedings, that change in circumstances could do one of two things. It could make it more difficult for Dr. McCreath to pay a maintenance award that was based upon a high level of earnings that he was realizing from the practice he's now sold. It might prompt Mrs. McCreath to return to court and say, Your Honor, all of the parade of horribles that the court faced in trying to ascertain a value based on a hypothetical sale that no one really contemplated, we now have not only a comparable, we have the best comparable. The practice has been sold. We now recognize what the value is, and Tracy McCreath could petition the court to adjust both maintenance and property division.
I don't think you can adjust property division in that manner, Counselor. I think there's case law that says that property division is final once the judgment of the court becomes final. You can't adjust maintenance, but I don't think you can adjust property division.
Well, flexibility is important. And in the event that there are changed circumstances, then trial courts should absolutely be encouraged to invoke their flexible powers to deal with change circumstances as they arise. Now, in the event that Dr. McCreath has liquidated the value of the practice, which now creates sufficient change circumstances that it would justify revisiting the maintenance award, there would be nothing to stop Mrs. McCreath from returning to court to modify the maintenance award on that basis. In the event that Dr. McCreath returned to court to modify the maintenance award based on a claim change in circumstances or inability to pay, at that point, the bona fides of the transaction could be examined by the court, and the court could mete out a just and appropriate result.
Did Mr. McCreath buy this practice?
Beg your pardon?
Did Mr. McCreath buy this practice?
He did buy the practice.
And did the person who owned the practice sign an non-compete clause?
It was the subject of a transitional services agreement where the seller stayed on, which is not unusual in the case of a retiring
professional. For a short time.
Right. And that raises...
And that price was more than the value of the tangible assets, wasn't it?
Yes.
Substantially more.
Substantially more.
Just
yes.
Like this is substantially more, right?
Exactly.
So that tells us that practices are bought and sold, and they're bought and sold at substantially more than, if it's a good practice, right?
Certainly.
More than the value of the tangible assets. So there's a market. I used to represent dentists. There's a market for dental practices, right?
Certainly.
And the value, usually the fair market value for purposes of divorce or for purposes of stock transfers, et cetera, is what a willing buyer and willing seller will negotiate, right? In fact, your brief says that.
Correct.
So there's a market. So we can – it's never easy to evaluate anything, a residence, commercial property, dental practice. But – there are techniques for doing it, and you come, we don't expect perfection, and we're not going to get it, right?
Correct.
Because it's a predictive value. All right. So why can't we do a fair market value and then divide it? And the usual division is 50-50. Doesn't have to be. Could be a little more one way, a little more the other way, right?
Sure.
All right. And you can have a corporation, I think Justice Ziegler said this, corporation which is increased value because of one or more employees, right, or shareholder employees. And we do that all the time. We value that. It's hard enough to value now to divide up between enterprise goodwill and personal goodwill. You're just making things much more complicated. Why do that?
Well, Your Honor, because despite the manner in which the question is framed, it's a narrower issue, and there's less variables, and there's a more reliable way to do it.
Like?
In the event that, well...
The way I hear you talking, you want the... It's over $1 million is the value, is that right?
Including all goodwill, that's the valuation.
Okay. You want to take that out of property division, right?
Not all of it.
You want to put $200,000-$300,000 in property division. That's the tangible assets.
Well, they asked, they were $247,000, yes.
Okay. That's what you want to put in property division.
I don't think the question was framed properly at the trial court level. I'm not foreclosing the possibility that because of the unique circumstances of this practice, there isn't value attributable to the fact that it is the only game in town in two markets that it operates in. That's nothing to do with
anybody.
Dr. McCreef, personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, he saw it, he bought it, he improved it.
Right, beyond the foresight of buying practice in that market. Now, maybe that acumen will go with him, but the value attributable to the monopoly status is not something Dr. McCreef brought to the practice or would take from it.
So what you want to do is go back and value that? Is that you want to go back and value that? The record is not good enough here?
It's not. It's plagued by an improper legal standard. And so by
And whose fault was that?
I think all concerned could take some responsibility. I think that Dr. McCreef's expert attempted to distinguish what he labeled corporate and professional goodwill, but what he meant was the difference between what's known in the briefs or referred to in the briefs as personal and enterprise goodwill. But his opinion was rejected by the trial court. Tracy McCreef's experts didn't draw a distinction, relied upon databases and valuation that didn't attempt to try to distinguish between the two or even value what, if any, professional goodwill existed.
Well, assuming we stay with that you're going to value this on the basis of comparable sales and that's a property division, I find the discussion of double counting challenging. I'm not sure how I come out on that. I'm not sure about the first one, but I find this one more difficult to understand. Yeah. So maybe you could walk us through that. So let's walk it through on the assumption that we're going to take fair market value, buyer and seller. We agree there is a market that we can look at. May not be totally comparable. Okay. So now we get down to, and each one of them winds up with half, let us say. Now we're going to go to maintenance, and I want to know why you think it's double billing to deal with giving the wife maintenance out of after she's gotten half the value. Because of the way I see it, it's like GM. I get half of the GM may not be a good example. Google, I get half the stock, right? Husband gets half the stock. It includes enterprise goodwill and personal goodwill, right? And maybe he's Mr. Google. I think I'd rather be Mrs. Google. I'll be Mrs. Google. So we're going to now, we've split the stock. Now we're going to do maintenance. Seems to me he's going to earn money every year, $6-7 million or more. That's sort of cheap. And why shouldn't the spouse get part of that as maintenance? It's not double billing. Still have the stock. That stock is still worth $1 million and can be sold in 3 years, maybe $1.5 million, right? So what's the matter?
Well, I think the analogy breaks down because Google is a lot more like a McDonald's franchise in terms of the separation of its goodwill, free and clear from its individual salespeople shareholders.
I'm doing fair market value.
Okay.
I want to get to the double accounting.
Your Honor, in this case, the fair market value approach by looking at comparables was not the approach. It was an income approach.
My example, I just really want to understand double counting. I read your brief carefully. I read Mr. Auerbach's brief carefully. And I even bothered to reread some of our cases, which don't really answer the issue.
Right. In a fair market valuation of a professional practice,
right,
one must look to the marketplace. And what was clear, and I think what commentators and courts generally recognize, is that the vast majority of sales of professional practices involve a non-compete and or a transitional services agreement. By definition, assuming such an agreement, the professional spouse has, hypothetically, but nevertheless, for purposes of dividing the spouse's property, relinquished some component of his or her ability to earn. And
nonsense.
So when you turn to maintenance, unless you account for that relinquishment, and you have double counted. If you're going to assume that the practice goes away, and in the process of the practice going away, the professional has relinquished the ability to exploit his or her professional reputation in the market where that reputation has the most value, but yet you look at historical earnings to project earning capacity as though that ability to earn remains intact, you have double counted. It's not necessary, and it's not just.
Now, you haven't sold this, right? His ability to earn money is still there. It hasn't been relinquished or mitigated at all by the divorce.
By
the sharing of the fair market value. He's still going to make the same amount of money.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. Because by assuming for purposes of valuation that the practice would be sold with a non-compete, you have compensated the non-professional spouse for that value, which the practicing professional never realizes.
If you had income-producing real estate and there's a divorce, you'd split the fair market value, right?
Yes. Yes.
He got the real estate and paid her off in cash.
Okay.
In my example. Now we're going to do maintenance. He gets income from that property,
right?
She's sharing that in maintenance. So why isn't that comparable?
Well, it depends. Because if you look at it more like a pension, where there is a principal amount that generates income, then the income that gets generated is income. The principal, to the extent that it was the subject of property division, is not.
That's because the pension plan on payouts is dissipated. And she already got that share when you gave her half of it. But to the extent that he earns more and gets more pension money, she doesn't share because he earned that without her. Right? And that's not the same thing as a building, which doesn't dissipate.
Well, with a rental building, its fair market value is to some degree a reflection of the income it is able to produce.
That's right. I accept that. And by good management and maybe personal ability. But you would count the income from that, I think, in maintenance payments. In calculating maintenance payments.
In that case, you would have to account for the cost going forward as a discount against the income to be realized because the building would have to be maintained, it would have to be insured, et cetera. And those are costs that would be borne entirely by whoever owned the property going forward. It wouldn't be fair to just look at gross income as a measure of its earning capacity.
Look at his net income from that building.
And the point, Your Honor, is that...
We have a fight about whether you look at depreciation, but that's another issue.
But that question is not fundamentally distinct from attempting to distinguish. If one has assumed now this, the practice has a value of X, going forward, what is the appropriate measure of earning capacity for awarding maintenance? Is it simply an income projection based on the practice's historic earnings? Or will there have to be discounts applied? Would, if you have assumed that in dividing the property there would be a non-compete, would it be fair and avoid double counting to award maintenance on any more than what a similarly experienced professional who earns a salary might earn in the event that the practice as an asset has been divided? That value has been counted already. I see my red light is on. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Richard J. Auerbach, representing Tracy McGreath.
Thank you. I am Richard Auerbach, and I do represent Tracy McGreath. Time permitting, I'll get to my actual prepared argument, but I wanted to respond to some of the answers given to the questions that have been posed during the initial argument.
Counsel, if you're going to do that, can you just clarify one thing that I was going to ask counsel? He said that Timothy McGreath bought the business. Was this something he bought before they were married? He bought it with individual assets. He bought it alone. There were no marital funds.
No.
Okay.
Let me just summarize the situation. The parties got married while Dr. McGreath was pursuing his orthodontic degree, but he received his degree a couple years after the marriage. All of his educational loans that he took out were paid during the marriage. The business was purchased for approximately $930,000 using marital funds, a combination of funds and payment from earnings thereafter during the marriage. Dr. McGreath testified that approximately $100,000 of that purchase price was the tangible assets, leaving somewhat over $800,000 of goodwill purchased during the marriage from marital funds. Chief Justice, you asked some questions about double counting, and I want to address that first. One of the big distinctions between a classic double counting problem and what we have here is, as I think you pointed out in one of your comments, the lack of dissipation of the asset.
That's the pension plan example.
A pension plan, although that gets complicated.
Different kind of pension plans.
Sure. Perhaps another example might be a bond that matures on a certain date and in the interim pays payments. It would not be fair to divide the property of two parties, award one the bond, and then consider the income as available for maintenance, because presumably the other party received a sum equal to that bond and could have gone and purchased his or her own bond and had his or her own income that would match it. At the end of the process, the bonds have matured. Each is left with the payout over the time, or in their discretion, they have sold it for whatever they could get for it. Here, however, at some point in time, including after death, this practice will be sold, unless it's run into the ground and becomes worthless, which is not likely. Whether that's because Dr. McGreath chooses to change careers, or because he has a debilitating injury or illness, or because he gets to retirement age, he will be able to sell it. And at that time, he should be able to receive 100% of the goodwill that is inherent in the value of this business, according to the valuations accepted by the trial court. As was pointed out, no trial court in Wisconsin has the jurisdiction or authority to reopen and modify a property division, other than for very limited purposes, such as correcting mathematical errors or to undo fraud. So contrary to opposing counsel, the situation would be that Dr. McGreath would realize all of the profit from the sale of his practice at such time as it sold and share none of that with his spouse, who was certainly substantially involved as a marital partnership in the creation of this valuable asset. The request that this court adopt a rule that is sort of inflexible would create sort of a black-letter law that personal goodwill is not part of a marital estate for purposes of property division if maintenance is awarded. It should be rejected. Statutes in this state provide that the courts, trial courts, are to divide the assets of the parties. The language is the courts shall divide. I am unaware of any asset that is deemed an asset sometimes but not other times. And yet that's exactly what this rule would create. If maintenance is awarded, they say, don't count personal goodwill as an asset. But if maintenance is not awarded, then it can be valued and divided as an asset. There's nothing in the statutory scheme to support that. Doing that creates a significant, cognizable risk to persons in the position of Mrs. McCreath or the spouses of professionals or even non-professional business owners. I can think of at least seven such scenarios that would cause unfairness to result as a matter of almost irreversible law if the rule was adopted. Number one, suppose Dr. McCreath dies. His obligation, as we know, to pay maintenance, done. So if that was 6 months after the divorce, my client would have received 6 months of maintenance. Dr. McCreath's estate would have a $1 million asset that it would sell. Suppose my client dies. Maintenance again. It would be terminated because she's dead. Now, it's true she wouldn't benefit from further payments, but suppose she had a child from her first marriage. Her estate would be lacking her fair share of the business asset, and her son or daughter from her first marriage would receive virtually nothing. Third, suppose she remarries. Maintenance is terminated. This rule would put every person who receives maintenance up against the choice of lose the value of the personal goodwill that is rightfully yours if you want to remarry. It's fair to cut off maintenance because the law assumes that the new spouse is assuming a duty of spousal support. But this isn't really maintenance. This is something of cognizable, substantive value that a remarried spouse would lose.
What rule do you propose?
I don't propose a rule. I think our system actually works pretty well, a rule.
What's the rule in our system?
The rule in our system is that we first determine the fair market value of the business. And that was done based on the most credible evidence before the trial court. Second, there's a presumption of equal division. Assuming a relatively long-term marriage, that presumption is fairly strong. But it is not graven in stone. There are criteria for which courts could justifiably deviate in the exercise of discretion from that equal presumption. For example, and I believe there have been cases, at least nationally, on this approach. Suppose you have an actor or actress or professional football player who has a special skill that the spouse really has nothing to do with the development of it. That person puts themselves into some form of a business. The business has value. It may not be fair to do an equal division of assets, but that's for the trial courts to decide. If the trial court believes that dividing the income after an equal division of assets that include using all of the personal goodwill that's saleable, that that's unfair to the payor, the trial court can adjust maintenance accordingly. I note that, as a court of appeals opinion points out, there is a portion of goodwill, personal goodwill, that is not saleable, that goes essentially to the grave with the person, the professional or the plumber or whoever it is because of the person's special charisma, special skills, etc. That's not here. In this case, the testimony of Ms. McCree's experts, which was credited by the trial court, was that there was nothing, it sounds demeaning, I don't mean it that way, nothing special about Dr. McCree. By that I mean, he didn't have any unusual or special skills as an orthodontist that other orthodontists don't have. What he had was he had bought this business, which is a monopoly. So should, in certain cases, a person leave the business with this special earning capacity that isn't factored into the fair market value, the court might be justified in actually adding to the income or to the maintenance. But the courts have the discretion to do what's fair. We've trusted trial courts for a long time to do that.
Counsel?
Yes.
What case is it? Cook versus Cook, I think. It talks about fairness. Essentially recognizes a disfavor with what's called double counting, whatever that is, but says, hey, you know, it's not written in stone. You can do anything you want, trial judge, as long as you exercise your discretion appropriately, and it's fair. You know, the Cook versus Cook is, let's get at the fairness of it all. What I'm having trouble with is trying to decide what kind of asset gives rise to double counting. And the example you gave is a bond. Let's say it's a $1,000 bond because the number is easy. And in the property division, he gets it. She gets something else, you say, but it would be worth $1,000. And then you cannot, you say, award maintenance based on the income that would come from that bond, because the theory is that she could take her $1,000 and generate some income too. So you say that to award her maintenance on the income from the bond would be double counting. That's what I heard you say. Well, why isn't a business, I mean, that's an income-producing asset. What distinguishes this business from your bond?
Good question. Number one, the value of the business is going to be realized at the end, unlike a bond that dissipates. Number two, the income from the business is an amalgamation of a whole bunch of things. It can be the labor of Dr. McCreath. In an appropriate case, it could be the labor of three other hired orthodontists that he pays $80,000 a year to. It could be the labor of a dental hygienist. It could
yes,
be.
I understand all of that. Is the chief was trying to use her, I think, pension because of the dissipation, but you didn't seem to buy into that idea that what distinguishes this fact situation, this professional practice, from the Kronhorst case, is it, is that there the pension, you know, would dissipate or something. But no. You didn't seem to buy into that.
I'm sorry if I gave that impression. I do buy into the dissipation argument as it was posed. Some pensions don't dissipate.
Okay.
They have survivor's benefits, and you have to, it isn't just a all pensions benefit, but all pensions dissipate. You'd have to look at them on a case-by-case basis. And that's, in fact, exactly what Cook versus Cook stands for. I'm going to quote from it, the rule against double, and I'm actually going to quote from Mr. Erlinson's brief when he says, the rule against double counting cannot operate as a rigidly applied bar. It must be flexible enough to address the facts of each case.
And I think that's just right on. But my problem is, there is disfavor with allowing double counting, and I want to know what constitutes double counting that should be disfavored initially, and then see if I can get over the disfavor hurdle by equity reasons. Why is this different than your bond example that you said, oh, double counting, can't do both?
Well, if you... You sort of get into some sort of simplified hypothetical examples, but if two parties start with the same level of assets and one pays a bunch of maintenance to the other, based on the earnings from that asset as an asset, not based on their earnings as an orthodontist or as a plumber. And the other, who has the equal amount of value, is allowed to retain all those earnings or put them in a non-profitable format or defer earnings. At the end of the period of time, whatever period of time you look at, the parties are not in an equal position. In other words, the party who is making the payments has 100% of the asset that they had, a fraction of their of the earnings. Party B has 100% of the assets, which is equal to the first ones, plus income from Party A to Party B, plus the earnings or appreciation eventually, or the enjoyment of the use, or the right to go to a casino and gamble, whatever it is, that value of her assets or his assets, 100% of that. So what you have is at the end of the 5 years or 10 years or whatever the time period is, the party receiving the earnings has received a bigger benefit than the party paying it, and that's not fair. When you look at this business, however, or this divorce case, the amount that Dr. McCreath is required to pay as maintenance doesn't approach equalized income. And that demonstrates or shows one of the other reasons why persons in Mrs. McCreath's position could be significantly harmed by this kind of a rule. Just touch on the facts. Dr. McCreath was found to have averaged 60 to 70 hours per week, per month. I was right the first time, per week. The trial court understandably felt that holding him to that level of work prospectively was not fair. The trial court then took his average cash flow and took essentially two-thirds from 60 hours average per week to 40, multiplied that fraction by his cash flow and said that's your income for purposes of maintenance. The business was averaging approximately $1.6 million of gross income per year. And the testimony of Dr. McCreath's own consultant was that the business had the potential of earning upwards of $2 million per year. So, roughly speaking, if we take two-thirds of those gross receipts, because we're going to assume that Dr. McCreath is down to two-thirds of the hours he used to work, that's $1 million a year in gross receipts. The business, because of its location, client base, retention of patients, et cetera, can earn double that. Suppose Dr. McCreath, rather than just cutting back, were to sell a 50% interest in his business to another orthodontist of some skill but no particular specialty, saying, you take Baraboo, I'll take Portage, or whatever. Presumably, that new orthodontist will pay approximately $514,000, half the value of the business, to buy in and be a 50-50 partner. The proper division is done. Mrs. McCreath would get nothing from that sale. Yet at the same time, there's enough work there for Dr. McCreath to continue his same income, earning that $1 million a year in gross receipts. There would be no reason to raise maintenance. There would be no reason to lower it. And so what would have happened is my client would have received half of $247,000 in tangible assets. Dr. McCreath, selling half the business, would have paid that off and have another $250,000 plus left over in his pocket and still owned half the business that he could sell when he chose. Suppose Dr. McCreath is offered a position as Assistant Secretary of Health for the federal government. No one, no trial judge, is going to say, that's shirking. So he sells his practice. He goes to Washington and earns $140,000 a year. Don't quote me on the salary. His maintenance
looks good to us, Mr. Harbaugh.
I'm sorry?
I said it looks good to us.
He goes to court, as he has the absolute right to do, and say, I can't pay $192,000 a year in maintenance on a salary of $140,000, not to mention look at the cost of living in D.C. The trial court says, your income's down, I'm going to cut your maintenance to 50 or 60 or 70 or some number like that. Well, what happened to the value of this business for Mrs. McCreath? It's in his pocket. He sold it for no ill reasons, not to get her or to work her over. I'm going to take you with me. Just perfectly legitimate. I got a great government position, high ranking. I think it's wonderful. I'm going to help the government. and she is the one that pays the price. That's just not fair. So whether it's for Dr. McCreath's death, Mrs. McCreath's death, her remarriage, him coming down with a disability or an illness that requires him to essentially sell his practice, his voluntary and appropriate job change, his actual retirement at some, 60, 62, 65, whatever he chooses that's reasonable, or the partial sale of a business. In each and every one of those examples, the trial court, if it had not included the personal goodwill in the valuation of assets, could not make my client whole. It's not just about Dr. and Mrs. McCreath, of course. It's about every businessman, businesswoman, and their spouses in this state. Right now, we trust trial courts to get it right, subject to appellate review, in the exercise of discretion. The danger of a hard and fast rule is that while it may work fine on some cases, it won't on others. And I think this court should be very, very careful before you strip trial court judges of the discretion to do what is right, to what is equitable, in their opinion based on the credible testimony presented at a trial. Briefly, one argument that was made in the briefs and reiterated briefly today was this will be simpler or it'll be more efficient. No, it won't. In my opinion, it will make things more complicated. Instead of going to an expert who says, based on the sale of 27, or in this case, there were 42 dental practices, sale or orthodontic practices that were valued for purposes of comparables, and let's come up with a fair market value, willing buyer, willing seller. We've been doing this for 100 years. We have to have expert testimony about what is personal goodwill versus what is enterprise goodwill. And believe me, if you think all experts will agree, think again. Even in this case, Dr. McCreath's expert, though found totally not credible by the trial court on this point, opined that 95% of the goodwill value of this practice was personal. Dennis Kleinheinz, an expert called by Tracy McCreath, had the opinion that it was basically the reverse. Mr. Erlandson argues in his brief, well, as we get closer to retirement, more of the goodwill will become enterprise and less will become personal. I disagree. But what is enterprise goodwill? What makes it up? What's personal? What's reputation that goes with the individual? What's something that can be sold via a non-compete or a transitional services agreement? The experts will have a field day. It will drive up the cost of litigation and drive up the time needed by trial courts to winnow from the varying and competing opinions. And yet, it serves no real purpose in this state. You look like you're about to ask a question.
Yes, I am. This talk about whether we can, when we look at other states, does it matter whether they're community property states? Pardon me?
I'm sorry, I thought you were...
Does it matter?
It's my impression that more community property states percentage-wise reject the majority approach than obviously the majority of non-community property states, but that there are...
Could you state that again?
What's the majority?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
First tell us what the majority approach is, then we can...
The majority approach is to exclude all personal goodwill. It is not a huge majority, but that is the majority approach.
Exclude what?
Personal goodwill from assets, period. There are some states that exclude enterprise and personal goodwill and simply value businesses at their tangible value. And there are a number of states that include both. The percentage of states that are not community property that include personal goodwill in assets is significantly lower than the percentage of community property states that include personal goodwill in an asset. In other words, you're more likely to be in a state that includes personal goodwill in the value of an asset if you're in a community property state, but you're not at all guaranteed.
Well, the reason I don't think it matters is you have to look at the community property state and how it treats community property on divorce. And in Wisconsin, it's all of the assets are put in and they're divided. So the marital property, we don't call it community property, the marital property rules don't apply at divorce. And in other states that have community property may be retained at divorce, separate or community, but not put into the total package the way we do. So I don't think that you can divide the states by community property versus versus non-community. I think you have to divide them as to whether they're equitable division on divorce or other aspects are taken into effect on a divorce.
I think that's true. I think all courts should be careful of comparing family law matters to the laws of other states, because a lot of time both the case law and the statutes involved have their own wrinkles or differences that affect the outcome. For example, there are states in this country where maintenance is limited to a percentage of the number of years of the marriage. In fact, in this state, there were proposals in the legislature that did not get out of committee to define maintenance between 0 and 10 years as 0, 10 to 15 years as times 0.3, and I think anything more than 15 was 0.5 up to 25, and then it was indefinite or something like that. None of these passed, but there are states that have these kinds of formulas. If you have a formula that says you get, on a 20-year marriage, you get 6 years of maintenance, you're done. You're kidding yourself if you think that in that six-year period of time, you can transfer half the value of what could be millions of dollars of personal goodwill to the spouse. It just can't happen. And maintenance is an income stream. It goes up, it goes down. It is susceptible to outside influences such as death, illness, and other things. I think it is not appropriate to condition my client's receipt of her fair share of this marital asset on both of their being alive and well enough to pay this maintenance over a period of time in the future. It's a gamble, and it's unnecessary, and it would work to the hardship of my client and the benefit of persons in Dr. McCreath's position.
I think Justice Bradley's question of just what you mean by double counting is really the tough one. And when I looked at our cases, I couldn't figure it out. And I think it may make a difference in the corporate bond example. If the bond is at present interest rates, then its fair market value might very well be its face value. But if it has a higher or lower interest rate than present prevailing rates, it may be higher or lower value. And that may make an effect on whether you consider it double counting, because the income stream has already gone into the value of the property. So
I would agree with that. If you had two bonds to be divided, one is at 12%, one's at 3%.
Right.
If one party gets to 12%, the other one gets 3%, it isn't an equal division.
Even if they're both $1,000
exactly.
Face value.
And under those circumstances, considering the extra income above the 3% would seem to be fair. There could be other factors that would make it unfair, but that's the point. If the parties start out equal, then the earnings or their decisions on their money, each is responsible. They shouldn't, you know, make a bad investment and come running back to the other saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, I went on a round-the-world cruise. My money's gone. Please pay me some of that. We already divided it. But when it's a situation like this business, which is his income, his reputation, the monopoly status, all of those things kind of all rolled into one, which my client, by taking care of the three children, and using marital funds to buy it, pay off the loans for his education and all that, there's really no reason that I've been able to find why she shouldn't get her fair share in a manner that, by property division, is sort of guaranteed, as opposed to the iffy maintenance approach. I would urge, I'm almost out of time, that there's no reason to enact such a black-letter rule that would create an asset for division if a party waived maintenance and an asset not for division if the party didn't. In closing, it makes it more complicated. Under the property division statutes, the courts are required to consider as a factor assets awarded to one party that are not subject to division. Suppose that the judge here said to Dr. McCreath, here's your entire business, less half of $247,000. Now the judge would have to look at, okay, he's got $800,000 in goodwill asset. She doesn't. I need to adjust the property division. At least I have to consider that as a factor in whether to deviate from equal division of property. Then, because we know property divisions are related to maintenance, that reconsidered property division has to be factored into how the court approaches maintenance. Everything is sort of linked together. The rule makes things complicated. Giving the court's direction to consider the possible double counting that could be involved and come up with a fair result is all this court needs to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Auerbach. Mr. Erlinson.
Thank you, Your Honor. To address Justice Ziegler's question, I certainly didn't mean to create a misimpression. They bought the practice. And for the same reason that a maintenance award based upon the earnings expected to continue from that practice would compensate Mrs. McCreath for that contribution in an annuitized form. In the event that one divided that asset and effectively reduced to net present value both spouses' contributions to that asset, including the value that one would attribute to Dr. McCreath forfeiting some portion of the value of his personal goodwill in a non-compete agreement, it remains fundamentally unfair then to turn and look prospectively and award maintenance as though his earning capacity is unchanged. Justice Ziegler, you also asked about community property states, and Chief Justice Abramson drew a nuanced and appropriate distinction. I think there's another distinction to be drawn, and that is personal goodwill, as it's defined in the cases and commentary and envisioned in Holbrook, it inheres in the individual itself, himself or herself. It isn't a separate asset to be conveyed. It's that person's ability to attract clients or customers or patients. And so in that sense, it's not a marital asset at all. Mr. Auerbach talked about what if Tim McCreath drops dead, he'd have a $1 million asset to sell. I don't know that he would. He would have some receivables. He would have a staff that needed to be paid. He'd have two buildings that he owned and had mortgages on. And there'd be nobody there to perform orthodontia. Now, there's monopoly status. That might be attractive to a buyer. But that person doesn't come to Baraboo or come to Portage with any particular cachet. Dr. McCreath isn't around to essentially bestow his imprimatur as an orthodontist on the new practitioner. And so to assume for the sake of discussion that the personal representative of Mr. McCreath's estate could simply wave a wand and conjure up a buyer willing to pay $1 million is not accurate. And so then, to assume for the sake of discussion that this is a $1 million asset, separate and distinct from Dr. McCreath's continued presence, is likewise unjust. Unless, of course, you're going to make an accommodation going forward, adjusting downward his earning capacity. Because if he's going to stay on and retire, he doesn't have an earning capacity that spans 20 years. If he grants a non-compete, he doesn't have an earning capacity that spans 20 years. Justice Abramson, I wish I'd been a little more nimble on your building analogy. Income property is income property. If I get half the value of the income property, I go buy another income property. That's fair. There's no reason the spouse who gets the income property and pays the other spouse half its value should have to pay maintenance based on the income from that property. It's not fair. It's double counting. Go buy a building. Hire a management company.
Well, in this one, and this bothered me about Mr. Auerbach's example, but he doesn't attempt to make this point, but when I read his chart, of which you were critical, on page 36, the property division she gets at $529,000, she can invest and get income.
Correct.
Right. And he maintains that $529,000 in the business, and he's going to draw out income from that business for services rendered.
Correct.
Right. And so you separate out the value of the of that property afterwards, what as it increases in value. And what you have from the professional services is that he continues to work, and it's from that that he gets income, and from that she gets maintenance.
Right.
That's the way I see this. And I think many years ago, and you probably cited in the brief, the court had a case where right after the male finishes a professional school but doesn't quite earn money yet, now they're divorced, and they have no assets and no income, and yet here it's a marriage of some long standing, and her all of her work kept them so that he could go to school, and she gets nothing because she can't get, court said quite clearly, she doesn't get a value of his future stream of earning because he's a professional. That's not dividable, not divisible, right? Because it's personal.
Right.
That's what the court said. And it made maintenance revisions and didn't use the usual a percent of current income, but looked ahead and said this is a way of doing it fair and equitably. So I understand your concept of, you know, it's, you can't divide the self.
My red's
yes.
Light's on. Can I have about 30
yeah,
seconds to respond?
Yeah, I want you to comment on that.
Madam Chief Justice, this is the rub of this case. The rule we propose seeks to identify what's the value if the professional spouse drops dead.
Right.
Okay? That's the value that's divisible. Everything else is must be looked at prospectively in fairness and sensitivity to the issues. To be fair, but to not double count, to value a practice based on what it's going to produce as income and reduce it to a net present value, and then award maintenance based on that same income stream is by definition a double counting of that value. And it's to be avoided. And the rule should be flexible. And that is why a presumption that is rebuttable. For example, when you have a spouse that is near the end of the career, those are comparables. When you have sales of practices. Because a practitioner selling a practice, that's the comparable. Here, you're in the middle of the career. You have a dissolving marriage. You have an earning capacity. With some foresight and a horizon that far away, the use of insurance, the allocation of payment of responsibility for premiums, and in the event of a change of circumstances, an adjustment to that maintenance award, whether long-term or on a limited-term basis, is by far more a fairer result than attempting to engage in a series of hypotheticals. And for that reason, we respectfully request that the Court reverse the Court of Appeals decision as well as the trial court's judgment of divorce and remand this matter for proceedings not inconsistent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olinson. Thank you, Attorney Erlinson. Thank you, Attorney Auerbach, for your arguments today on a case that raises a topic we've dealt with before and not totally come to grips with it, either on evaluation or in terms of what double counting means. Very difficult issues, and ones that are faced by the trial courts every week or day in Wisconsin. That concludes our hearing on 09-AP-639, Tracy J. McGreath versus Timothy J. McGreath. The court will meet in a closed conference at 10 after 3. We are in recess until tomorrow at 9:45.